Aaron Sanders Law. Create, innovate, protect. The solution for copyright and trademark needs.
Thank you all for coming this morning. I apologize that I cannot give this talk in any language other than English. Feel free to ask questions as we go through, and if you are more comfortable asking the questions auf Deutsch, then you can ask Dr. Nordemann and he can translate, and we will have hopefully a good conversation as we go through this. I will spend the next hour and a half or so familiarizing you all with U.S. copyright law, and I will try my best to point out the differences between U.S. and German and European copyright law, but you all know the European side of it better than I do, so there may be some points that are different that that you can point out to me. We do in the United States obviously have a Copyright Act. It's in Title 17 of the U.S. Code, and that's where our we spend most of our time looking at statutes. But one difference in the U.S. is that case law is much more important in terms of its development of the law. So when cases go up to the courts of second instance or to the Supreme Court, those cases become precedential. They have influence on later cases in a way that I understand is very different from how it works here. So case law is as important in the United States as statutory law. There's a certain amount of administrative material relating to copyright law that comes into play in mostly when you're already in litigation and you're looking to see whether, for example, a copyright has been registered properly. You look to the administrative law, but that's generally less important. But statutes and cases are equally important in the U.S. and the case law, because there are so many cases happening all the time, the law changes and it develops and it evolves in a way that's, I think, different than it happens here. So I will just throw out that caveat as we get started. Some of this, and I'm sorry that I chose green for these slides, but fix that for next time. What I'm going to do in this presentation is talk about the scope of protection for about the first half of it, what rights a copyright owner has, and then where the limitations on those rights are and what rights the public may have in those works, either at the end of their life or if they're in the public domain for some other reason, or if they're being used in a way that's fair and free. So we've kind of divided it up that way. So the scope of protection, copyright generally protects original works of authorship that are fixed in any tangible medium of expression, now known or later developed, from which they can be perceived, reproduced, or otherwise communicated, either directly or with the aid of a machine or a device. So the two key portions, of course, are the ones that you can't really read, are the works must be original and they must be able to be fixed. So they can be reproduced and shown or displayed again. A good example of a work that would not be fixed would be a sandcastle. So you might design an incredibly original, unique sandcastle, but the next time a wave hits it, it's going to disappear and it can't be fixed and moved, and so therefore it's not protectable. A garden design that is going to change as the seasons change and the flowers die, for example, not fixed, therefore not protectable. The threshold for originality in the United States is fairly low. You do not have to have written the next Shakespeare play in order to reach a level of originality for copyright protection, but it has to be more than merely functional. So our most important case on this in the United States was a case about a telephone book. And the listings in the telephone book were done merely in alphabetical order by last name. And the telephone book owner tried to sue someone who was copying their book, and the court said, there's no other way to logically make a telephone book in a way that somebody can use. And so putting it in alphabetical order is not enough originality in order to be able to be protected by copyright. So that's our scope of low threshold of originality, fixed works, and once you get past those two thresholds, you can have copyright in your work. Once you have copyright, then the question is, what are the rights that you have in that work? And I think these are fairly similar to what it is in Germany. We think about these as sort of a bundle of rights that can be taken apart. They can be transferred, which we'll talk about later, in different ways, and they don't all have to be kept together all the time. But it's pretty much anything creative you can think of. Literary works, anything that's written down, including software, code of software, can be protected. It is in the United States protected in the same regime as literature, which is awkward, but that's how we do it for now. Musical works, dramatical works, choreographic works, as long as they're written down, sculptural works, visual art, motion pictures, sound recordings, which we'll talk about a little bit more later on, and then architectural works, which have a limited realm of copyright. So pretty much anything that you can think of in the creative world, in the academic world, all can be protected. What can't be protected? Ideas. So ideas are the realm of patent law. Copyright protects the expression of an idea and not the idea itself. If there's another way to complete the same task with a different set of instructions, then the functionality is not protected under copyright law, only the instructions. Titles. So you can, of course, have trademark protection in a title. So J.K. Rowling certainly has trademark protection in the Harry Potter name and the Harry Potter brand, but she has no copyright protection in the title of the Harry Potter books. Short phrases and slogans, which again are more the purview of trademark law. And then familiar symbols or designs. And we end up having a lot of debate with our copyright office about what constitutes a familiar design. So this pink circle with the cross in the middle of it, which was for a hot yoga studio, was denied by the trademark office for registration because they said that the symbol was just simply too familiar, too basic. There was not enough originality in that to be protected, and so it wasn't. About 2 years prior, Copyright Office had allowed registration of the mark on the right, which is a globe with stars and horseshoes, which is not exactly unfamiliar, and certainly each of the individual elements of that are all something that we've all seen before. So trying to articulate why one of those designs could be protectable by copyright and the other one cannot is obviously difficult, and sometimes this is merely in the eye of the beholder. This is an Oracle watch mark, and so it had some famous trademark logos behind it, which may have something to do with why the Copyright Office merely recognized its fame and therefore thought it could be registered, but we really don't know. As we go through this, and I think this is probably true in all areas of law in all countries, but we don't always know what the judges and the offices are going to do. So once you have your rights, or you have a work that can be protected by copyright, then the question is, what are those rights? You can make copies of the work. You have the exclusive right to make the copies. You have the exclusive right to make derivative works, which are modifications of the original work. You have exclusive rights to distribute the copies of the work, to sell copies of the work. You have the exclusive right to perform the work publicly. You have the exclusive display right, which is generally what applies to visual art more than other kinds. And then you have the right to perform sound recordings, which are in their own special category, publicly, but only by digital audio transmission. So what this means is that artists in the United States, sound recording artists in the United States, get paid a performance royalty, but only when their works are performed on digital radio and not when they're performed on analog radio. It's a major difference in the United States with other countries. It was a throwback from when radio first started and radio was seen as a promotional tool for artists. And so they gave up the ability to get royalties on the idea that when a song was played on the radio, it would promote the sale of records and the artists would make their money this way. But since the 1920s, artists have not gotten paid their performance royalty when songs are played on traditional radio. We have a fight about this every year in Congress because the radio stations are saying, well, if we have to pay a royalty on this, it will just amount to a tax on us. And of course, we'll go out of business and the world will end. And the artists are saying, basically, this isn't fair. And of course, it's different for artists around the rest of the world. So under our treaties and the fact that artists have to be treated the same in different places, what happens is when a song is played on German radio by a U.S. artist, that money doesn't get paid back to the artist in the United States because it's not getting paid from the U.S. to Germany. So there's a big black box sitting at GEMA, a metaphorical black box of millions and millions and millions of dollars of money that should be paid to artists in the United States, but is not because of the equal treatment laws under the treaties, and it's just sitting there. So, as radio goes more towards digital, I think the artists are starting to see more money, but that's a big hole in copyright law treatment in the United States.
I mean, what are the arguments about that you don't take the digital or an analog type in the same way? I mean, it's just the technical difference, but it has no reason why you should have advantage because of the digital audio transmission or the analog one. I mean, is there any from the opponents, is there any argument about that?
The rates that, I mean, it's a very good point, and it's obviously the strongest argument that the artist side has for why they should be paid their royalties. There's no reason to treat them differently, except that the regime under which artists were not paid happened first, because we had traditional radio before we had digital. And when digital radio started, they took the opportunity to lobby successfully in order to get paid a royalty. The rates are different and they are lower. I'm sure you all have Spotify now, which I was very happy to find out when I came here, actually. But the rates, for example, that artists are paid, and Spotify is not a good example because it's on demand as opposed to, you know, Pandora. But the rates are much, much lower. And the digital broadcasters just didn't have the lobbying power in Congress that the traditional, the National Broadcasters Association in the United States has. So very often these are less a question of law and more a question of who has the negotiating power when you take the issues to Congress to make the new laws. So we're still fighting, though. One stick that does not show up in our bundle of sticks, our bundle of rights in the United States, is the neighboring right. It is simply not a concept that we use in the United States at all. We have some limited similar concepts having to do with record companies and movie studios owning the rights to the creative works that get produced there, but this only happens by agreement and not by operation of law. And we'll talk about this more in the when Dr. Nordeman talks to you about treaties. So this is one of the major differences between U.S. and European laws, that there is no neighboring right. Works vest in their author almost exclusively. There are certain exceptions when the author of the work is an employee, but that is generally not the case with artists and records companies or actors in movie studios. That right simply has to be transferred by a contract, and doesn't happen through neighboring rights. Another lost right in the United States is the moral right. We have a very, very limited moral right for visual artists to have attribution attached to their work and not to have their work destroyed or modified. But that is it. There are no other moral rights for any other kinds of artists in the United States, and the rights can be waived by contract. This is another one of those areas, like with neighboring rights, where when we talk about the Berne Convention later, we'll talk about whether or not the United States is really in compliance, because moral rights exist for artists everywhere else in the world. There are minimum treatment standards under the Berne Convention, and we just simply don't have them. The copyright term in the United States is pretty much in line with what it is in the rest of the world, except that ours is much more complicated. Copyright work in a work vests upon creation and lasts for 70 years from the death of the author. That's the first rule. And that rule applies for works that were created after 1977, so as of January 1st, 1978. And the reason for that is that our copyright law changed. We wrote a new Copyright Act in 1976 that became effective January 1st, 1978. And the new term scheme, which we then extended in 1998 to go from 50 years to the from the life of the author to 70 years in order to bring us in line with the rest of the world, then only applied to the works that were created after 1978. There are different terms for works made for hire, which is a concept we'll get to in a couple of minutes. If the work is anonymous or pseudonymous, if it was written by under a pen name and the author is unknown, then the works have copyright from 95 years from the date of first publication or 120 years from the date of creation. And publication is a concept that we'll talk a little bit about. It used to be in the United States that if a work was published first without a copyright notice on it, because we had strict formality rules, that it would go immediately into the public domain. So this provision actually pulled works that had been published without their notice from the public domain back into protection and gave them 95 more years. So it seriously extended copyright protection for certain kinds of works. I'm not going to get too much into the details, and I would get it wrong even if I tried, about exactly how to calculate the copyright term for works prior to 1978, but this is the chart that we have to look at to decide. Pretty much if it was created before 1923, it's in the public domain. That is a blanket rule. Anything between 1923 and 1978, we have to look at this matrix to decide whether or not it's in the public domain, whether it was originally published without notice and fell into the public domain, whether it was renewed when the copyright statute required renewal of registration or not. And it requires some deep knowledge of the facts of the history of that work with respect to its registration and with respect to any transfers that might have taken a place of those rights. So it's pretty complicated. We don't always necessarily have the information that we need to make a determination. And so when our clients come to us and say, can I use this work? Is it in the public domain? I say, is it from before 1923? And they say no, and I say, I have no idea. But it's not all that often that we are dealing with older works, fortunately. Again, about copyright notices, this is one thing where we did decide that we would comply with the Berne Convention. It used to be that you had to have the circle C on your works when you published it. That is no longer true, although by practice, many, many people do, and of course you all are familiar with that affixation. Copyright with the C, the year of first publication, the name of the copyright owner. If you do use the notice, and again, most people do, then it still has a benefit in the United States. If a defendant infringes on your copyright and uses the defense of innocent infringement, that they did not know that the work was registered, that notice will, that the work was copyrighted, that notice will eliminate that ground of defense for them. They can no longer say that they didn't know. Questions so far? Good. Another big difference between the United States and Europe is, and this sort of informs a lot of what's going on of importance in copyright law in the United States now, is that works can be sold. The copyright owner can transfer not only a copy of the work, which of course does not transfer title of the work, but they can actually transfer title. Copyright is seen as an asset in the United States, just like a car or property would be. There are very specific rules about how that can be transferred, primarily because when Congress put in the transfer rules, they really wanted to protect the artists. Artists were signing terrible, one-sided, disadvantageous deals with publishers and with record companies, and didn't always know what they were signing. So Congress wanted to make sure that artists who also aren't necessarily reading their contracts before they sign them would not accidentally transfer their copyright. So the rules are pretty specific. But in general, copyrights can be transferred. There are certain limitations involving works of visual art because the artist still has those rights of attribution and integrity. And a transfer can be done either by license, which I think is also the way it can be done here. The license can be exclusive or non-exclusive, but it can be sold. So, and we'll talk about how that can be done. So, as I said, and I think this is true across the world, just handing over a copy of the work does not transfer the copyright. But transfer of copyright can happen in a number of different ways in the U.S., either by operation of law, or by will if the author dies, or in bankruptcy if those copyrights are part of the estate. The trustee or the executor of that bankruptcy estate can also transfer the works. If it doesn't happen in any of those ways, then it does have to happen under a written and signed agreement. The agreement has to be signed by the person transferring the copyright, and it has to be signed, and it has to include in the language what we call a present transfer of a future interest. So the words "I hereby assign" or "I hereby transfer" are very important words to have in that agreement. And there was a pretty important case in the Supreme Court just a couple of years ago, Stanford v. Roche. And again, these cases are precedential in the United States, so this law will affect any similar case, or this court case will affect any similar case coming after it, especially Supreme Court cases. Mr. Roche was a researcher for Stanford University, and he had a contract with Stanford for his research and for his papers about that research that promised to assign those works when they were finished to Stanford University. He then left Stanford and went to work for a private company and signed a more standard agreement with that private company that says, I am now assigning all of my interest in work that I've done on this research. Stanford sued Mr. Roche when they found out that he no longer owned these works and tried to get them back from the private company. And the Supreme Court said the contract between Mr. Roche and, I believe it was Sirius, was the company, was written correctly and effectively transferred those rights, whereas the contract between Mr. Roche and Stanford University was merely a promise. Mr. Roche broke that promise, and Stanford has a breach of contract claim against Mr. Roche for damages, but one of the remedy available to them does not include actually getting ownership of that copyright material. So the way in which these contracts are written can make a huge difference. One way that a work can actually be automatically transferred is in a concept known as work for hire. And this, again, is something that I don't think has any place in European law at all. A work for hire is a work that is prepared by an employee within the scope of their employment, or it is a work specially commissioned for use within a certain number of specific categories, and the parties agree in a signed writing that the work is to be considered a work made for hire. So this first category is for employees, and the second category is for independent contractors. But independent contractors can only be brought in under a work made for hire regime in a specific number of categories. Anytime an employee, so if someone is working for an advertising agency, for example, and does an ad spot for a client of the company, all of that creative work that went into that ad belongs to the company, not to that individual. If an independent contractor comes in and works for an advertising agency, they might sign an agreement that says all of this is a work for hire and the company owns it from the very beginning, but we have to look at whether or not this advertising work would fall into one of the specified categories. And it probably wouldn't. The categories are a little strange, and I'm sorry I didn't put them on the slide, but they include things like atlases, test questions, exams, maps, certain contributions to a collective work. So, for example, if you wrote one chapter of a book, or, for example, if you worked on a movie and you made a small contribution to a singular work that would be then later protectable by copyright. But it's not at all clear that if an independent contractor came in and worked on an advertisement for one client, even if they signed an agreement that promised that this would be a work for hire, that the law would actually recognize that as a work for hire. So usually what you'll see in those contracts with independent contractors is language that says, this is a work made for hire. But if it's not a work made for hire, then I, as the independent contractor, hereby assign my rights. So we kind of do a what we would call belt and suspenders protection so that we make sure that we're getting ownership of those rights either through work for hire or through assignment. There's a reason that this matters in the U.S., and it has to do with termination rights. So works made for hire are considered to be owned by the employer from the moment of creation. All other works are owned by the author from the moment of creation and then assigned. And works that are assigned can be subject to a termination right. So if a transfer is an assignment, then the author has the right to terminate that transfer and take their rights back 35 years after the date that the transfer was executed or signed. Congress included this provision, again, to protect artists who were signing bad deals. So an artist, you know, signed away all of his rights in, a songwriter, for example, would assign all of his rights to a catalog in the 1960s, and he would assign it for $500. And then one of the songs would become a huge hit, which would be used in movies, which would be on all kinds of compilations, and the publishers would be making tons and tons of money off that song, and the artist wouldn't see any more of it. So 35 years later, the artist would basically have the writer would have the opportunity to renegotiate that deal with their artists, with their companies. So it's a really good way for artists to get what we call a second bite at the apple. But there are no termination rights for works for hire. This only works when there is an assignment. This is really important right now because this 35-year, there's a slightly different termination window for works prior to 1978. There's kind of a demarcation line pre and post 1978. But for works that the execution happened after 1978, this 35-year window comes into play. If you go 35 years out from 1978, you end up in 2012. So all of the rights that were assigned or by transfer in 1978, in the next few years thereafter, are right now becoming subject to termination. So all of the big hits from the late 70s from American artists, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel, the Eagles, some of which I hope you all have heard, some of which you can do without, but YMCA, they're the Village People, the YMCA song. And then, interestingly, it's not been just musical artists, but comic book creators had big hits in that. So there are Superman comics, Batman comics that are right now coming up for termination because those artists were not employees. They were simply independent contractors who then assigned their rights to the publishers and now get the opportunity to renegotiate their rights. So, yeah.
Is it somehow a discussion in America, copyright law, to like we have it here in Germany with their like fair compensation after you have like success with your work? You have like 32A Copyright Act, German Copyright Act, where you get like you could get the fair compensation when you made a deal, a bad deal in the beginning. And who did something in discussion?
So this is similar, but who decides what the fair compensation is?
The author and the publisher or the opposite side.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's a negotiation.
It's determined by what is fair and adequate.
Okay.
So the market standard does not always have to be, fair as well. So there is a certain kind of balancing of interests or so. But if you look, for example, to the music side, and you will have a performing artist who can claim a Section 32A, like additional royalty, then you would look what kind of status that artist has, and then you would draw a comparison to what comparable artists might receive as a royalty.
But often those cases are privately negotiated between the artist and the other side.
Yes. There's one case, this Elvis Presley case going on, which I think I've told you about, where the Appeal Court of Munich, there's a published decision on Elvis Presley recordings, And in this case, 13% of the turnover was claimed as adequate, as equitable remuneration.
Okay. So it sounds like that is actually somewhat similar to this right, except for the fact that this does include a complete termination right. So the artist can simply take back ownership. So,
but just after 35 years. It's a long time.
That is true.
Some songs, I mean, they're like one-hit wonders, and you can still listen to them now. Yeah, but they have to wait 35 years until they get the rights, and that's a long term.
Yeah, that's true. And so for somebody like Meghan Trainor, for example, I don't know if that song made it to Europe, but All About the Bass. Did you all get this one? It was a huge hit in the United States last year.
Of course, it was a huge
hit. Okay, all right. See, I don't know what exports anymore. But so huge hit last year. Is it going to be a huge hit in 35 years? Probably not. Is there still going to be any money to be made off of it in 35 years? As opposed to some of the American hits that were written in the late 70s and early 80s. It's a good question as to whether or not this will be as effective going forward in, you know, for the next generation of artists. Now, it could be. There could be more evergreens, but there are lots of reasons why it's probably less likely. And so you could certainly make an argument that the system that you all have in place is more effective. Because not only do they have to wait 35 years, but there's only a very limited window of time. It starts in 35 years, and they only have until 40 years, and after that, they've waived their rights. So there are certainly some complications that an artist needs to be aware of, or their lawyers need to be aware of. Other questions on termination? Yeah, so this is the reason that it is really important from the U.S. perspective as to whether or not a transfer is an assignment or is a work for hire. Another reason that it's important to know whether or not your workers who are creating these works are employees or independent contractors is that, again, your independent contractors don't fall under the work for hire without a written agreement at all. And so you can often find, if you haven't had a written agreement with a contractor, that you simply don't own the work that they've done. And this is actually pretty common. It's a good thing to keep lawyers busy, because I represent a lot of startups in Nashville, and they will usually have one guy with the idea and the money, but not the technical skills, and so he'll hire a software developer. Say, yeah, here's, you know, make me this website, give me this brand new app, you know, I'll give you 10% equity, we'll worry about the contracts later. And the developer hands over the app, the idea guy may or may not actually pay, there may not actually be any equity, and all of a sudden they say, you know, we're ready to sell the company, and our developer is claiming that they own this, and you look at what paperwork they have, and none of it includes an assignment or any kind of written agreement with the developer, and unfortunately, the developer is correct. So written agreements are extremely important. We will talk about copyright infringement cases. And we'll do a couple of in-lecture case studies here, but I'll give you the answers on these. Two elements to a copyright infringement case in the United States: whether or not the defendant had access to the underlying work and how similar the works are. Access is important because independent creation is a defense. If two people write the same novel in New York and California and they had no access to each other, then those two works can coexist and there's no copyright infringement. But if the guy in California read the New York guy's work first and then rewrote it, then suddenly you have a copyright infringement claim. Substantial similarity, again, it's substantial. It does not have to be identical. It is determined usually by the ordinary observer test, meaning whether an average lay observer would recognize the alleged copy as having been appropriated from the copyrighted work. And because it's an ordinary observer test, and for a lot of other constitutional reasons in the United States, copyright infringement cases are very often decided by juries in the U.S. So juries are not limited to criminal cases in the United States. We have them in all kinds of civil cases, including copyright infringement, and they can decide not only whether or not two works are substantially similar, but also what the damages are. Whether the work, when the work includes both protectable and unprotectable elements, the court, including the jury, sometimes has to separate those and use a discerning observer test, sorting out which elements are protectable from the ones that are not. and we'll look at a couple of cases. So we said substantial similarity is often decided, and in this case was decided by a jury. This was the case of the song Blurred Lines. It was Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams versus the Marvin Gaye estate.
Everybody get up.
Guys, tell where one song started and the other one stopped, other than by the slides. So, a couple of facts about this case. Robin Thicke testified in court that he had never heard this Marvin Gaye song and it wasn't any influence to him at all. This was on the question of whether or not they had access to it. There was no direct proof that Robin would have ever heard the Marvin Gaye song, except that he had written given an interview for a magazine maybe a year before the trial, saying that when he and Pharrell were talking about the next song that they would write, that they really wanted a Marvin Gaye vibe. So he came across as a little less than credible on the stand, but this was a jury case. And who thinks it was infringement? Can't raise a show of hands. Who thinks infringement? Who thinks not infringement? We would have had a hung jury in this case. So the jury thought that this was infringement, and this created a huge controversy in the music industry about how no one can ever use influences from other genres again, because they're always going to get sued for copyright infringement. But with jury decisions in the U.S., they are actually, even though they're court cases, they're not precedential. So only the judge decisions, usually again in the court of second instance or in the Supreme Court, are going to have influence on later cases. So a case like this is highly fact specific, and it's difficult to know exactly what the basis of the decision was. The jury heard all the testimony and decided which witnesses they believed and which ones they didn't. But they decided infringement, and they also decided damages in this case. And it was something on the element of $5.5 million, because damages in a copyright case, I have another slide on this in a couple minutes, are based on the profits of the infringer. And so however much money they made on that song. Yeah.
But the damages is nothing the jury will decide.
It is.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah. So they will, the plaintiff in the case will say, well, we have these records that show that the defendant made $8 million on this song. And the defendant has the opportunity to say, well, not all of those profits were attributable to the infringement. Some of it may have been from a licensing deal for another song, and we just bundled this in, or it may have not been for the whole song, for example. There are different arguments that they can make, but the jury hears all of that and actually makes the determination as to what the damages are in actual damages cases. We have statutory damages as well that we'll talk about in a minute that are judge decided. But juries in the U.S. have a lot of power. Parties can opt out of jury trials and request a bench trial, but it has to be decided by either party can ask for a jury trial. If it's just going to be a bench trial, both parties have to agree to that. One more case. So as I said, you have to take out the unprotectable elements of a case of the work and just focus on what's protectable. Let me see if I can remember which one. Yeah, so I think the one on the left was the original. Hopefully you guys can see this in the light. And then the one on the right was the infringement. Can you see the beard on that? So you have to take out the judge. So in this case, it was a discerning observer test, and I think, and yeah, in this case, there was no jury. This was a judge a bench trial. So the judge in this case had to determine what the unprotectable elements of Santa Claus were. So he says, well, you've got a jolly elderly man with a round stomach, a white beard, and a red hat. But in both of these cases, it's a little blurry. Santa Claus has a mustache and not a beard. And in both of these cases, Santa Claus is wearing a scarf and then has a snow globe in his tummy. So mustache, scarf, snow globe, tummy, not necessarily common elements of a Santa Claus statue. So infringement, who says yes? Got three. Who says no? Three against two. So majority wins on this one. The court said that the elements that were not unique to, or not common to Santa Claus, the mustache, I think the mustache probably did it more than anything else, because Santa Claus just always has a beard and hardly ever has a mustache. And the similarly tied scarves and the snow globes was enough to say that there was copying. In this case, I don't know what the access evidence was. The less substantially similar the two works are, the more access evidence you have to have. And I just simply don't. It's not part of the record in this case. So, yeah.
I mean, you had enough opportunities to make another or look it differently. You know, the arms are exactly the same, for example, and you could do it differently.
He doesn't have to be standing like this.
It's the same thing, so it's too much a resemblance of the original work.
Exactly. That is a good way to think about it. So remedies, we talked a little bit about this. Damages that are available to a copyright owner, they can get injunctions and have the infringing works pulled off the market. They can have them all destroyed. They can get the damages and profits of the infringer, which again is often decided by a jury. And then they can get statutory damages. Statutory damages are available from an amount of $750 up to $30,000 per work, or up to $150,000 if the infringement was willful and bad faith. This is in lieu of actual damages. So you make an election. And these statutory damages, and we'll talk about this, we'll talk about it now. So $750,000 to $30,000. The advantage here is that if you don't know what the profits are, or if they're really not very much, you can elect for statutory damages and eliminate the whole proof aspect of having to prove actual damages, and also often get more money than you otherwise would have. However, statutory damages are only available if the work was registered before the infringement actually happened. Berne Convention requires the elimination of all formalities. In the US, copyright registration is still available. It is not mandatory. However, you cannot file a lawsuit in the United States for copyright infringement without a registration certificate from the Copyright Office. It is not terribly expensive. It's $35 to get a registration, and it takes about 4 months to get a registration certificate back from the office with a file stamp. The date of registration dates back to the date of filing, but it just takes a little while to get the registration certificate. And the courts in the United States are actually split on the idea of whether or not having sent in an application is good enough for grounds for filing a lawsuit. Most of them make you wait until you actually have the certificate in hand before you can file the lawsuit. The Library of Congress has been the register of copyrights in the U.S. since the founding of the country, and the idea originally was that they wanted to collect all the creative works being made by their citizens. Obviously, the country got bigger. That's a lot of work. And also, when we acceded to the Berne Convention, we had to eliminate the requirement that works be registered, but we still wanted to be collecting as much work, as much creative work as we possibly could. So this was seen as the balance between our desire to archive all of these works and what our obligations were under the treaty. The requirement for registration does not apply to ex-US applicants. it only applies to U.S. citizens. So that was the other way that we sort of dealt with it from a treaty standpoint. But registration is still an important part of copyright law in the United States. So that is the scope of protection and the mechanics of protection. And we'll spend the next half an hour talking about the limitations on those protections. And the first one that we'll talk about is fair use. So
I was wondering, do you have in the States kind of like pre-trial thing like we have in Germany, a legal notice or something before you go to court, that you write the person who is probably infringing your copyright in terms of costs in the trial? Do you have something like that?
So we send cease and desist letters in the United States so that we try to resolve the disputes before going to trial. I think, and maybe actually you can explain this a little better, I think that cease and desist letters in Germany have more power than they do in the U.S. because
the question was, is it mandatory? Because like in Germany you have to do it to for the cost?
No, it is not mandatory. Okay. It is not. Most people do, because obviously going to court is extraordinarily expensive and you try to resolve it privately. But the judges don't like it very much if you just simply file a complaint without having tried to work it out, and the defense can use that against you, but it is not mandatory.
So in Germany, Tara, it's also not really mandatory. But if you sue somebody and have not sent a cease and desist letter beforehand, then the defendant can accept all your claims immediately, and then you have to bear all the costs of the proceedings as a plaintiff. You see, so it reverses somehow the burden of costs.
Okay.
And this is, in fact, of course, the main, let's say, procedural result a cease and desist letter may have or may not have.
Yeah.
But of course, I mean, from the practical point of view, if we send out cease and desist letters, probably in 50% of all cases, there is some kind of solution and this matter will not go to court then in the end, because then there will be another attorney who will check the case, and you can discuss whether it's infringement or not, and then there may be some kind of solution. So I would say, as a thumb rule, probably 50% of all cease and desist letters have an effect to solve the matter.
So one thing I didn't put on the damages slide, which I guess I probably should, is talking about costs, because I think those work differently too. In Germany, right, it's loser pays. Is that correct?
Yeah. The loser pays.
Yeah, that's actually different. In the United States, each party bears their own costs unless it's a bad faith case. And if it's willful infringement or if the defense is a particularly bad actor, the plaintiff can ask for their attorney's fees. On the other hand, if the plaintiff files a malicious lawsuit or a meritless lawsuit and the defense is able to have it dismissed, then the defense can also ask for their attorney's fees. But it is not an automatic loser pays system in the U.S. So we are more litigious. We sue more in the U.S. than probably anywhere else, but clients are very conscious of the fact that this is going to cost them a lot of money. And very often we will tell them it's simply not worth it. You cannot get enough damages from this case, and attorney's fees will not be available to you. And so it will cost you more to file the lawsuit than you could possibly gain from it. The Copyright Office in the U.S. is actually trying to solve that problem for independent artists who might have a copyright infringement claim, and especially if the infringement claim is against, you know, a celebrity or a big artist. We are actually handling one of these cases in my office right now where a songwriter went to a songwriting workshop. They have these in Nashville where you work with veteran songwriters and they teach you the ways to write a hit song. And she took a song that she was working with to this songwriting workshop, and the songwriter then collaborated with Brad Paisley, who's a country artist in the U.S., to write a song that sounds an awful lot like our client's song. But she really had to... That case is working for her because her father is actually the lead litigator on the case. He's actually handling the court case. So it's less expensive for her than it otherwise would be. But for an artist who didn't have that kind of a connection, they might have a really great case against, you know, Brad Paisley, but he's got fancy, expensive lawyers, and she's dealing with Sony Records and EMI Publishing, and the legal fees can just rack up so high that even if she could get a lot of money from it, she simply can't afford to file the lawsuit. So the Copyright Office is working on a proposal for a small claims court in the U.S. so that independent small artists can file lawsuits that will, it'll eliminate a lot of the normal procedure that goes on pre-trial. There'll be a limitation on the evidence that's exchanged between the parties, and so, and the costs, the filing costs for the lawsuit will be significantly lower. There will be a cap on the damages, but it will always be economically beneficial then for the artist to be able to file the claims. So we don't have it yet, but we'll, but hopefully that will come soon. So, other questions on damages, costs? Okay, on to fair use. Fair use is another important and fairly different concept in the United States from Europe. You have specific exceptions to copyright infringement in your statutes. But in the U.S., there's no specific list of exceptions except for parody and purely educational use, which is why I can play you these songs and not get sued for it. But fair use is a concept that's based in the United States Constitution. The Constitution says that copyright is to advance the progress of the sciences. It cannot advance the progress of the sciences, the thinking goes, unless people can use copyright in order to create new works. To an extent, also we have free speech rights under the First Amendment. So, but Congress didn't really want us to give, or want to give us specific exceptions the way that you have in Germany. What they did was they created a framework of factors to consider when deciding whether or not a use is fair. And there are four of them. And it includes the purpose and character of the new use, namely whether or not it is commercial or for nonprofit use. So the if the new use is commercial, it is more likely not to be found to be fair, but that's not a blanket rule. The nature of the copyrighted work, whether the underlying work was highly creative or less so. I actually strongly disagree with this one. The example of a less creative work that's often used is a scientific manual, which may be highly functional, but it certainly rises to the level of originality required for copyright protection, and I don't think it should be offered less protection than a Harry Potter novel should, for example. But that's just my own little aside. Amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole. In other words, how much of the underlying work did you take? And then probably the most important one, because it's always all about the money, is the effect of the use upon the potential market for the copyrighted work. So are you competing with them in their own market? Anybody wants to make any notes on that? I'll leave it up for just a second. All right. Okay. I keep picking on Harry Potter, but it's just so easy. So, gosh, it's really hard to see. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows on the right, the Harry Potter Lexicon, which was a website created by a guy in the United States, 2,300 Reasons to Love Harry Potter. The online lexicon included descriptions and cross-references and relationships between all of the characters. For every character, for every book, every animal, maps. This guy had way too much time on his hands. In deposition testimony, J.K. Rowling actually admitted that she used the lexicon in creating some of the later books because it was so complete. She actually really enjoyed it, but she still didn't want it up because she thought it infringed her copyright. So the guy, as far as I know, didn't make any money on this, at least not up at the time that the lawsuit was going on. I don't think that there was any testimony that there were advertisements put on the website. I don't think it got that much traffic. So this was purely a hobby. He didn't sell it. He didn't have any commercial interest in it. So we go back to the fair use factors. Purpose and character of the use, including whether or not it's commercial. this probably wasn't a commercial use. It certainly wasn't a highly commercial use. That factor may favor the guy who created the lexicon. The nature of the copyrighted work, Harry Potter, pretty creative, right? How much of the work did he take? Pretty much all of it. Pretty much at least every single character and every animal. There were extensive quotes on the lexicon. It wasn't word for word, you know, every word in the original book, but it was a whole lot of it. And then effective use upon the potential market or value of the copyrighted work, J.K. Rowling testified that she had an interest in making her own lexicon when this case went to trial. So what do you think? Fair use? Who says fair? Why do you think it's fair?
Because he didn't make any money on it.
Because he didn't make any money on it? Okay. Okay. Do you have any... You raised your hand, so...
I agree.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable.
Okay. Okay. So, factors 3 and 4, because those were the two that went... So who thinks it's not fair? I guess I should ask that question, too. Nobody. Really? Okay. So, the judge said... the judge, I think, wanted to find fair use on this case, but ultimately said that because Rowling had made credible testimony that she wanted to create a lexicon, that this could be competitive, and also I think the ultimate factor in this case was the fact that he had taken so much of the material.
I'm sorry, but I don't like this argument, because I think Wu tells her that maybe she uses his work as her own, you know, it's just she has the copyright on the names, trademarks on Harry Potter, etc. But that's a fandom work, and actually it pushes her own work because the community or the fans can work with it. She herself works with it. And just if she plans to do a lexicon for herself, I mean, it doesn't mean that this contradicts this work, and it feels very bad explanation, I think.
So, very often, and you'll see this on YouTube, right? You'll see someone say, this is for promotional use only, no copyright infringement intended. Promotion of the underlying work is never a defense in a fair use case. So, whether you think it should be or not, it isn't. With respect to whether or not she had plans to create her own lexicon, I agree with you. I have problems with that argument. And the reason I do is that what this says is the effect of the use upon the potential market or value of the copyrighted work. She's suing on the novel she's already created. She's not suing on a lexicon that hasn't happened yet. So, I think that was a little disingenuous. But I think, at the end of the day, this one was what finally killed it for him. But the fact that you guys weren't sure whether or not this is fair use is how all juries feel, certainly all attorneys feel, and you can tell in the opinions often how judges feel about this whole concept. It's,
can I say something?
Yeah.
Because I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
With the assessment that, not with the outcome of the case, but with the assessment that it is not an argument that she wants to create a lexicon about her work. You see, copyright law reserves every kind of exploitation of a work somebody has created. So the exclusive rights... especially under German copyright law, but also, of course, under US copyright law, the exclusive right to exploit the work in every means possible is reserved to the creator, to the author. And, of course, if you write a series of novels like Harry Potter, which is a very dense and very complex story, told in these 7 books, of course, to write a lexicon and to somehow take up all the different aspects of the Harry Potter novels again is a certain form to make an adaptation. You see, like to make a movie. A movie is also not the same as a book, but to make a movie out of a book is also reserved to the author, or to make a translation, or to make it, to have the work appeared in a different form. So if somebody does a lexicon which is not like, let's say, a mere lexicon which says, so in which, on which page Dumbledore will appear the first time or whatever, but if it takes up also the contents of the book, somehow retelling the story of Harry Potter only in another kind of format of the book, I think this is a valuable argument that she says, well, this is something I may consider to do later, and therefore it should be reserved to me as the author to decide whether that should be made or not. And we had comparable cases on, because we were in my firm, and also I personally, we were representing Warner Brothers and Ms. Rowling in many cases against Harry Potter piracy. And we had numerous lexicons which were forbidden by the courts in Germany. So that was already like 10 years ago, but where really people were then, you see, so you could look up, for example, Albus Dumbledore, and then the lexicon would tell you on about two or three pages what Dumbledore's background was, when he appeared, in which book he appeared, in which connection, and so on. So it was somehow a summary always of the story around the people playing in the book.
I agree with you on the German Copyright Act. Of course, that's not possible, and it's a gray area at all. So if you do like a wiki for made by fans, and you have a problem in Germany, it's also the German... attracts the German readers and so on. But I think the fair use is actually made for such things, in my opinion, because there are a lot of, the whole lot of pages with for video games, for example, where you have the lore of the background of the games, and it's the whole site, the website, just exists with these knowledge out of the games or the books and so on. And I mean, and I think everyone I talked with said, okay, we can do this just because of the fair use clause, and as long as we do it not in the commercial way. And I always thought that it's maybe the reason why it's possible in the US law to do it. And so I feel like, I mean, that you really need to discuss sometimes about books and so on, and if you forbid that, I mean, the author is how to say, I'm a little pro the fans on this side, because I think it's
yeah, but you see, this is another very interesting aspect, because Warner Brothers and Ms. Rowling, they were of course always somehow paying attention to not disrupt the fan scene, you see, and when something was really published by real fans, then they would somehow find a way to find a compromise with these fans. For example, we had these, when the seventh book was published in English, there were like fan sites or fan communities who were starting to translate the English book, which was published like 3 or 4 months before the German last book was published, and giving to every member of the fan community like 4 or 5 pages, and so and if like 150 people are each translates 5 pages, then it takes you 3 days, and then you have a translation of a whole novel. It may not be very accurate and not be always like in the same kind of style. But that was not like, it was of course some, if you publish that on the internet, then it's of course a copyright infringement, because you can do a translation on your own, but you are not allowed to publish it. But the let's say the settlement with the fan community in these cases was always that they somehow had to limit the access of the site to the members of the fan community. So they were not allowed really to publish it to everybody, this translation, but they could share it among each other.
So, but if you just write about it, you don't quote the novel itself, you just write, for example, a book summary or write about a character in your own words, make up your own words, using, of course, the terms of the lore, of the background. I mean, is it really forbidden?
Yes, and the German copyright law.
We could do a whole hour on fan fiction, seriously, and we can talk about that. I want to get to a couple of other cases to maybe make you feel a little bit better about fair use, but yeah, I wanted to make sure you were able to ask your question too.
I'm always wondering when we are discussing about things like can somebody write something about a piece or something, if copyright law is really the right place to talk about that, because now this case is Harry Potter, which is like a very, very successful piece, but for example, not very well-known authors, whatever, they wouldn't sue people for like bringing their pieces up. And so I'm always wondering as well in Germany if our copyright law is made for these cases.
So,
Interesting.
And I bet in the Harry Potter case, and I haven't read it recently, but I bet you anything, she brought trademark infringement claims for the logos, no question. Unfair competition is less codified in the United States. It is a trademark law lives under an umbrella of general unfair competition law, but it's not relegated by statute quite as much as it is here. But your point that this works very well for famous authors, but maybe not so much for lesser known authors, for example, I think is a good point, but people are so much more likely to copy famous authors because they're trying to pass it off and they're trying to use that author's reputation and the fame that author already has. And so your point that maybe this is an unfair competition claim is, I think, a good one. But for the content, we're still in copyright.
Because I'm wondering, I mean, copyright laws protect the work and not like the fame out of the work. So it's always something which is in my mind when we're talking about using pieces or characters for other works. I always have a problem to discuss this in the matter of copyright law. I don't know why. For me, it's not the right place. The laws like that, I know it.
You could write a very interesting academic paper about that. Okay, so again, I'm hoping that this is going to make you feel a little bit better about where fair use is going if you're on the pro-user side in the room. There's this concept that has sort of taken over fair use in the United States called transformative use. And I've just got a quote up here from, almost read it there. So the Supreme Court in 1994 had to decide a case where Two Live Crew had taken a Pretty Woman, the Pretty Woman song by Roy Orbison, and turned it into a rap and made it nasty, basically. It was a wholesome 1950s song. Two Live Crew basically turned it on its head. She wasn't a pretty woman anymore. She was a prostitute walking down the street, et cetera, et cetera. The Roy Orbison estate was not at all happy about this and sued. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court basically said that this was a parody, that it commented on the original work and on the message of the original work about a wholesome white America, essentially. And for that reason, it transformed the underlying work. The court said, if the secondary use adds value to the original, if the quoted matter is used as raw material, transformed in the creation of new information, new aesthetics, new insights and understandings, this is the very type of activity that the fair use doctrine intends to protect for the enrichment of society. Transformative uses may include criticizing the quoted work, exposing the character of the original author, proving a fact, or summarizing an idea argued in the original in order to defend or rebut it. So that was in 1994. Blank slide. Transformative use kind of languished in the concept, gosh, you really can't see that, languished in the concept until 2010 or so, when Amazon.com was sued by Perfect 10 magazine. Perfect 10 was a risque, not quite pornographic magazine, Amazon had made thumbnails of the images that were the magazine covers. They would take a magazine cover like that and shrink it down for a thumbnail to be searched on Google. And Perfect 10 did not appreciate their images being copied for search purposes, and so they sued Amazon. So in this case, the court said, well, yeah, you took the whole work, but first of all, no one is going to look at little thumbnails instead of going out to buy the full magazine, because that doesn't have nearly the same effect. You can decide whether or not you agree with that. And second of all, those small images are used only for searching for the actual images of the magazine, which may be copyright infringement in and of themselves, but that's a different point. And so the purpose of this use is entirely different from the purpose of the magazine covers. And therefore, it's transformative, and therefore it's fair. So that was the start of the idea of transformative use. Now let me turn the sound down on this just a little bit. Okay. The band is Green Day, if y'all didn't recognize it. A concert promoter for Green Day found this poster hanging on a fence in East LA. Green Day was getting ready to do a concert for the American Idiot album that included the song East Jesus Nowhere. They took this poster, blew it up into a backdrop for the stage. And I hope you all can see this. So, backdrop on the stage, sort of spray painted a red X over it, and then sang the East Jesus Nowhere song that's about sort of the disintegration of society and hopelessness and despair and all of that. Fair use? Who says fair? Who says not? Nobody knows, right? So the court said this was fair use. It's an identical representation, except for that it's blown up. But the court made a big deal of the fact that this red X was spray painted over the top of it, and that it was put up there to help to promote the message. Can we put these blinds down just a little bit more? The sun is kind of coming out. That it was used for the purpose of giving context to this song about hopelessness and despair. Now, I don't know what the original purpose of this poster was that didn't have anything to do with giving context to the ideas of hopelessness and despair, but there you go. So in this case, putting a cross over the work and playing a rock and roll song while it's up there was enough to make it transformative. And this is how we got to Google Books. So Google Books was, there were two cases. Google Books had partnered with libraries in the United States to digitize all works for the purpose of searching, so that you could search for a page number, basically to digitize card catalogs, essentially, so that you could find the page number and also the place in the library where the book was, and also to make the works available by Braille or by audio for disabled patrons. Go. So that was the partnership with libraries for searching purposes. That was the HathiTrust case. And then there was also the Google Books project, which I'm sure you all know still exists, which the purpose of which is to digitize all content of all books anywhere in the world. You guys have used Google Books? Yeah. So you know it has these snippets that are sometimes 10, 15 pages of a book. That didn't exist in the HathiTrust case. It was just for searching purposes. So the court had to decide two of these cases, and the HathiTrust case came first. And the court, we were up in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in New York, which is a fairly important copyright court in the U.S., said, well, yes, they are taking the entire work and they're digitizing it, but what Google is doing is a huge public benefit. They said, and the purpose of those works is no longer to read them, but rather to search for them and to find relevant topics and where you can find them in the book itself. And also the benefit of making works available to the blind and disabled is so important that we're going to consider this fair. But the court in that case also said that transforming a work from print into digital was a transformative use. So when they got to Google Books, they had this case to rely on, and the Google Books case just came down from the Second Circuit in the last 6 months or so. And Google Books is safe because that information is not replacing the market for the books because they only give you snippets, so says the court, and people are still going to go out and buy the books. How many people in here go to Google Books because they can't buy the textbooks? Yeah? Yeah? It's okay. I'm not going to turn you in, but yeah, right? Or don't want to buy the textbooks or don't want to go down to the library to check them out because the information is available on Google Books. So anyway, Google Books in under U.S. law, and the Supreme Court actually just declined to hear the case, which means that that Second Circuit decision is final. So Google Books is fair use. So to me, it seems that we've come a long way at expanding fair use in the United States, which some people might think is good news. I will reserve my opinions about it, but it's an evolving area of law. It's not the kind of question where our clients come and they say, can I use this? Is it fair? Where we really feel like we can just give an answer to that. It usually comes with a lot of qualifications. So, questions about fair use? Comments? We'll talk more about it in the case studies. We have in the United States the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which governs our notice and takedown procedure for getting infringing content taken off the internet. I know you all have a similar concept. Ours is statutory and highly procedural, so there are certain elements that have to be in the notice in order for the notice to be effective and to require the content hoster to actually take the information down. And you also, in the US, generally have to post it conspicuously in your website terms of use. And you have to designate an agent and file the name of the agent with the U.S. Copyright Office so that that person will be the one to get those notices and takedowns. And it's like a $140 filing fee for the first website and then something like $50 for every website after that to designate this agent with the office. So this is not a cost-free process, and my clients are very often surprised about that. But it has the same, I think the end result is the same, so the infringing poster has an opportunity to respond if their material has been taken down. But as long as the procedure is followed, then the online content poster has immunity from the copyright infringement suit. And then finally, I leave exhaustion for when we're all exhausted at the end. Copyright exhaustion and first sale. I think this is also a similar concept. Once a particular copy of a work has been sold, the new owner of that work can do whatever he wants with that copy. But the operative phrase in that provision is when the work has been sold, which we'll talk about in just a second, as opposed to licensed. We had an important case in the U.S. a couple of years ago. John Kerstang was a student at the University of Berkeley in California who decided that he didn't want to be a poor law student anymore. And so he was a South Korean immigrant. He sent his relatives in South Korea to go buy books from shops in South Korea at about 20% of the cost of what they were in the United States, ship them into the U.S., and then resell them to students at Berkeley. And he made a killing, like $1 million in his first 2 years or something. So I think it's a brilliant business plan. Wiley Books didn't like it very much. And the question was, because the first sale doctrine in the U.S. says that the provision applies to works lawfully made. So if the copy was pirated or infringing in the first place, you can still control downstream distribution and pull it back out of the market. But if it was a legitimate copy when it went into the market, then the original owner releases control and their rights are exhausted. So the question was whether or not these works that were manufactured outside the United States under agreement by Wiley and therefore legal copies were lawfully made under the Act. Were works that were created originally outside the United States under the Act of the U.S. Copyright Office? And the Supreme Court said yes. So what Mr. Kersting was doing, and I imagine he's still doing, is perfectly legal under the Supreme Court. And of course, Wiley Books and all the other academic publishers said that the world was going to end and it was going to destroy the educational system. And as far as I know, this case was in 2012 and it hasn't yet. So there you go. So that is my presentation to you about, oh, and fair use, about U.S. copyright law. And I'm going to let Dr. Nordeman talk to you about international treaties, and then we'll see how all of those things work in real life in the case studies in the afternoon. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to attorney Tara Aaron's presentation on an introduction to U.S. copyright law. Ms. Aaron delivered this lecture to students at the University of Dresden in July of 2015. Thanks for listening. If you have additional questions, please visit AaronSandersLaw.com.